Hello and welcome to everyone. My name is Vladislav Farapanov and I am a global community lead with Rubrika. Rubrika is a Ukrainian media outlet that is focusing on solution journalism approach. And on behalf of Rubrika, let me say it's a great pleasure to welcome you tonight. And of course, as we already mentioned, the event will be published as a podcast. We are on every major platform speaking about podcasts, so you can subscribe and follow us there. The title of our podcast is Solutions from Ukraine. We are really the driver of solution journalism approach in Ukraine and Eastern Europe. As always, we dedicate our events to the armed forces of Ukraine. Without any further ado, I would like to start. So it's been more than 2 years since Russia started the full-scale war against Ukraine. And some people assume that international attention around Ukraine or on Ukraine is declining, especially compared to what we've seen in the first days of the war. And in my view, it's kind of understandable and predictable, but many in Ukraine really wonder actually what to do with that. I would say both at the government level and in civil society, which is always actively pushing for reforms, kind of pushing for more action from the Ukrainian government. And that's what we'll be talking about today. And of course, we will ask our speakers about their professional and personal experiences. So let me introduce our distinguished speakers, and we'll talk about these issues with them more comprehensively. So today with us is Yulia Drozd, ABC News producer. We also have Christopher Miller, who is Financial Times correspondent for Ukraine, and he is also the author of the book The War Came to Us. And we also have Sean Carrier, who is a freelance journalist. So thank you, three of you, for making it. And I think I would like to start with Chris. The amount of, you know, kind of disinformation around Ukraine is really enormous. And I have to confess that I haven't read the book, but the amount of presentations that I've seen that you have been doing over around 6 months, I would say, it's really enormous. And even the fact that these book presentations were made, I believe, is also great. So speaking about the disinformation, the decline in attention around Ukraine, actually, what would you say to those around the world? Why should they keep interest high in Ukraine right now after 2 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. Thank you very much, Vladislav, first of all, for inviting me to discuss all of this with you. I think that's a good question. And certainly we hear a lot about Ukraine fatigue, right? And none of us here, I know, want the world to turn their attention away from Ukraine. In my personal meetings with people who are either visiting Ukraine or who I meet when I am traveling, or speaking to at the various events that I'm a part of, I always do tell them that it is important to not lose sight of what is happening here. I argue to them that, I think what happens in Ukraine is going to have a big impact on the rest of the world. Many people that think Ukraine is some faraway place or that the war here doesn't impact them, I think, that's the wrong way to think, because I think certainly this war does impact them. It already has. The war will have ripple effects that will change people's lives in the United States, in Europe, in other countries. And if they want those ripples and changes to be positive for them, for Ukrainians, then they need to invest in Ukraine, in Ukraine's victory. They need to support Ukraine. I think if Russia wins, then it could very well lead to a global power realignment, and it would certainly have a big, and I think a bad, security implication for all of us. It would embolden Russia, it would embolden China, Iran, North Korea. These are all authoritarian countries. and they would be aligned against us in the West. They would want to take advantage of a weakened Western alliance. And so I think, you know, this is, you know, the argument that I put forth to people when I meet them, that, you know, if you want, you know, if you want things to change for the better, you know, you need to invest in Ukraine and its victory.
Absolutely. And I would just like to ask a short follow up, because I believe that it is exactly what some Ukrainian officials actually were trying to make, you know, to make this point that even if the war seems to be really far away from you, it's really not. And kind of you're right about mentioning the global implications. But do you think still that this particular approach is really working, especially with those who, you know, either not supported Ukraine so much or was trying to stay kind of neutral?
Yeah, you know, I think if we want to go further, and these, you know, those messages that I just, you know, told you that I typically tell people when I'm in various places. Hold on 1 minute. I'm getting a strange message here about my speaking language. Anyway, you know, I think if we go a step further and we think about specifically who we are speaking to, then we can add in various details and arguments to try to persuade them, right? I might not need to explain so much of this or the importance of it to, let's say, a Democrat in America who is supportive of President Biden and his policy vis-a-vis Ukraine. I might need to do a little bit more work in trying to convince a more conservative, Trump-supporting Republican that it is important to do so, right? And so I would think about how to do that. One way that I actually have spoken to people who are Trump supporters and are skeptical of Ukraine is to address some of the concerns that they claim to have. For example, they claim Ukraine is a corrupt country. They claim that Zelensky and leaders here in Ukraine are stealing the money that America is giving to Kiev for its defense. Now, those things are not true, and all of us here know that. But a lot of Americans who are Trump supporters, you know, they hear his messages, they think that there is some, you know, some truth in what he is saying. And so they want answers to those questions. Now, you know, I'm not Ukrainian, but I've been here for 14 years and I know the political system very well. I've met all of, you know, the Ukrainian leaders from 2010 onward. And I know this, you know, the system, I know about corruption and, you know, Ukraine is not a place without corruption, but there is also corruption in the United States and in every other country I've ever been to and reported on. And so I try to put it in perspective for them. And also to tell them, at least when it comes to, I'll pluck out one little thing here, the assistance and the billions of dollars that are going to Ukraine, that money, a lot of it is actually staying in America. So the financial support that the United States gives to Ukraine, a lot of it goes to manufacturers in the U.S. that are producing the weapons that the United States is providing to Ukraine. So they're actually this money is actually creating jobs in the United States and in many Republican red states that are not necessarily Democratic states or you know would vote for Biden. So I tried to make those points. And you know, I think that I've maybe convinced a few people here and there. And I think, you know, any one person we can convince and sort of bring over, you know, to our side of understanding is a positive development.
Okay, thank you. I would like to get to Yulia next. Basically, what's your take on keeping international audience in focus after 2 years? Actually, I think it would be really interesting to know actually what you and your colleagues are doing to change the status quo, you know, and get Ukraine back to the top of headlines of news.
You know, thank you for inviting me to this discussion. It's really interesting and important. So I don't think it's correct to say that Ukraine is not in the spotlight anymore, because everyone remembers about Ukraine whatsoever. It's just that there is a natural news cycle. We remember that the media and the TV channels are businesses, and they have to switch to other things that they are happening, for example, like what is happening in Gaza, in Israel, and wherever. So if Ukraine appears less on international media, it doesn't mean that the audience does not remember and does not understand what is happening in Ukraine. ABC has done a great job covering the events in Ukraine, because we have been here since not just day one of the invasion. We have been since like 3 months probably before the start of the full-scale invasion, and we have been here constantly. We had one, two crews covering, being on air every day on top shows on prime time. And of course things change a little bit since early October, when the events in Gaza started to happen. But still, Ukraine is being discussed in the US. And that's why. And of course, ABC is not a totally international channel like CNN. It's more like an American channel. But still, if we appear on air like 2 or 3 times a week, it's still okay. It's still really good, because the audience doesn't need to see every day what is happening, especially if nothing is happening. Of course, we're covering some big events like strikes and Russian planes being shot down, whatever. But again, my key point is that if Ukraine is not on the news, on the screen, on air every day, it doesn't mean that the audience does not remember. What we should do, or the politicians, or diplomats, or activists, whoever, what we should do is keep explaining to people what is happening, keep reminding them, keep communicating also, because unfortunately, I don't see the Ukrainian government doing it in the right way as other people would do, as I would do it, as other people would suggest they should do it. So, yeah, I think that's a key point.
Okay, I think we'll actually get back to the end of your statement just in a couple of minutes, and I would like to turn to Sean. And Sean, actually, before asking you a question, I would like to say that Sean has been helping Rubrikar as part of the team, and we do appreciate it so much. But actually, Sean has like a lot of experience in international reporting as well. And I wonder, actually, what's your reflection on how media adapts to new realities in the context of a war in particular, if we're talking about Ukraine?
I think when you speak to Ukrainians, they would tell you that the point of the international media is to let people know about the real situation on the ground here. And Ukrainians most often say, "Tell them to send us weapons. We want to sleep at night. We don't. We need air defense. We can't sleep with the ballistic missiles like flying overhead and exploding. At 4 in the morning." I think the media's purpose and responsibility is to put people in conversation with the people they share this planet with, and that demands to sort of stay in contact with what people are, what's really on people's mind. And it's true that people around the world, news fatigue is real, and it's not unique to Ukraine. It's unique. It's really universal to people are tired of war. People around the world, it seems like there's only bad news. And that's something that the media have to adapt to. And I think the way is to really listen to people and not, as Julia said, if people feel the media are giving them the same story all the time. That creates mistrust, it creates boredom, and people change the channel. And there's plenty of other things that people could entertain themselves with rather than investing their energy in caring about a conflict that happens on the other side of the planet. I would say that so media need to listen to audiences in order to keep their attention and put them in conversation with real people, with what we feel in Ukraine. And I think that that can be done by, you know, addressing that issue head on, that people are tired of hearing only bad news. And that's something that Rubrica strives to do, is to say that there's more than just bad news. It's actually people who are doing things that are innovative, that's, you know, to address the war. And that's also, you know, showing what real people are living through and doing something about, because nobody here wanted to change their life and have to go to war. Nobody wanted to have to bury their friends and their loved ones or be separated from their husbands so that they could be on the front lines so that they can continue their life. But those are real people who are living through that. And if people don't care about it, then I think that that's just because they are comfortable looking away. And we as journalists have to continue to sort of remind people that this is the reality here, and this is their neighbors. If Ukraine comes under Russian occupation, that's going to be Poland next. That's going to be Latvia or Lithuania or Finland. And in the next few years, Ukraine is, whether Russia likes it or not, Ukraine is going to be getting closer to the EU. And that means that people in Poland and Slovakia and Hungary are going to start learning Ukrainian in school. And people in Germany are going to have Ukrainian representatives on the, there's a Ukrainian representative on the, to the Berlin Senate. That's, now that you have Ukrainians are integrating into European society, that is going to be people's friends and neighbors. And they're going to benefit from listening to the people that they share their city, country, and world with.
Absolutely, Sean. And I would just like to add kind of very quick that I believe in Ukraine we also like basically all of us really need some good news. But of course, the point of solution journalism is to be kind of solutions oriented and to seek kind of constructive solutions and stories and cases that that may be applicable kind of many times. So I would like to move to the second block, you know, and let's talk more about actual journalism. And I would love to start that block with Yulia. And actually what you said before really kind of resonated with me, what I heard yesterday participating in a forum of strategic communications in Kyiv, and the communication advisor of Ukraine's foreign minister Dmytro Kuleba actually mentioned that it is important to stay optimistic within Ukraine and to show that optimism, you know, internationally, like, because if kind of we are in Ukraine talking about that the attention and the like assistance is declining, then kind of the narrative really sticks, and some in the West or like around the world are also actually starting to believe that. And I constantly see on social media that you're always looking, you know, for some people, for your stories from different angles. And my question is, actually, what types of stories, in your view, are better disseminated in terms of coverage right now and at the beginning of the full-scale invasion? Like, are these personal stories, as we sometimes call them, kind of war testimonials, or those, you know, providing more context, like explainers or or maybe there is another format that in your view is more relevant and applicable?
Great question. And you know, it has a few aspects. First of all, as I said, media, a TV channel, it's a business model. A TV channel, say ABC, has, say, two primetime shows, Good Morning America, which is a morning show, and then World News Tonight, which is an evening show. And these two different types of shows will want a little bit different stories because the audience is different, because people have different mood, you know, in the morning and in the evening. And that's why different kind of stories might work. We also have different correspondents who, of course, they understand in general what is happening. The top priority is always news of the day, but they also have their, you know, personal preferences as for the stories, what they consider to be important, what they also have different skills, you know, like, for example, talking to people and making them open up to you and making the story even more compelling to the audience. At the beginning of the war, there were lots of news in general. There was a lot of things happening. And, you know, the very fact of Ukraine beating Russia, repelling the attacks around Kyiv, the counteroffensive in Kharkiv, counteroffensive in Kherson, were major leverages, or say points where the attention of the audience grew, and the audience actually believed in Ukraine's victory. These were the events that made the audience believe in Ukraine's victory. Also, things like hitting the Moskva flagship or other Russian landing ships or planes. Things, news like this make audience believe in Ukraine's victory. Also recently, and I've been telling this to my colleagues in the security service, for example, in the military intelligence, I told them that these structures have been given a lot of news, and most of the news that we're interested in are usually coming from SBU and the military intelligence, because they are hitting something in Crimea, they are shooting down the planes, they are hitting, for example, Russian oil refineries, and this is a big deal for the West, you know. And there is also an aspect of, I'm talking about the US now, right? For example, we have Democrats and Republicans, we have people who are fans of Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And for example, if we're talking about the Republicans, what types of stories are more compelling to them? One are stories about Russian atrocities, like rape, etc., what happened in Bucha, Izum, wherever, there are multiple places. And also, as I said, things like Russian warship being destroyed. Big deal for them. It really, it's, on one hand, it's something compelling to the audience, which makes the audience come to our channel, and this is this makes profit. On the other hand, this is some kind of communication between Ukraine and the US audience, what makes what results eventually in their support for Ukraine, and eventually results in some probably political decisions, because they are taxpayers and their voters. I personally also write for ABC digital platforms, and they're interested in various types of stories. Latest is mobilization, for example, or I think we will be the first foreign media covering lack of labor force in Ukraine, which is kind of an economic paradox. When businesses are growing and developing, but they can't find people. There are physically no enough people to fill in all the positions. So different types of stories work for different platforms, different audiences, different shows. And As we're talking about the solution journalism, you know Valery Peker, which is a prominent Ukrainian economist and philosopher, I would say so. So recently I read a post of him on Facebook, and he quoted Robert Sapolsky, who said that when we are too empathetic, when we see someone's stories and we feel this story, we feel it so deeply that it makes us turn away from people and not help them. But if we are seeing this story in a cognitive way without emotions, it prompts us to help people. So this is what solution journalism does. I think, of course, TV in particular and social media are more about emotions. But if we could somehow add this solution aspect, that would probably be a better communication.
Yeah, indeed. I would like get back to Chris. Of course, you're welcome to reflect on what Yulia just said, but I would also like to ask you very, very important question. I believe many Ukrainian journalists will also love to listen to this podcast. And how can Ukrainian media help you or other international journalists that are constantly in Ukraine, or those who are come and go, especially those with the English language pages like Rubrika, for example, and many others, you know, basically, what's the best way of kind of collaboration between Ukrainian and international media, for example, as the Financial Times is?
Yeah, good question. I really enjoyed listening to Yulia there, by the way. She had a lot of really good things to say. I would just, in short, before I answer your question, just say that, you know, working in print media, we think about stories, which stories we tell and how we tell them, similarly to what Yulia did. It's just, it might be a little bit different. Well, yours is a medium on television, you know, in print, you know, in a newspaper, there are only so many sort of ways to tell a story. But, you know, because we have a very active website, we do also think in terms of visuals and that means videos and photographs and multimedia type journalism too. But anyway, I thought what Yulia had to say was very interesting. On your question, you know, I read a ton of Ukrainian media every day. That's what I do when I first wake up in the morning. Besides pouring a very large cup of coffee these days, because we all get very little sleep because of Russia's missile attacks and air raid sirens here. You know, the first thing I do is open Ukrainska Pravda, Novaya Vremya, or New Time, Liga. What else do I read? Mirror of the Week, everything. And, you know, I typically read, you know, read the sites in their Ukrainian form. And then, you know, I do follow their English language sites as well. I think, you know, for the broader public, what I think is interesting is how many Ukrainian sites have turned to developing an English language section of their website, or also formed or started an English language Twitter or social media account. I think that has really helped just generally for the general public. Oftentimes it is Ukrainian media who knows where to get the first reports from the president or from the prime minister. And it's oftentimes Ukrainian media who first has the sort of, you know, news out there, and they're very quick about getting it out in English. You know, so that is useful, I think, for a general audience. It also is useful for myself, how active Ukrainian media is. You know, I look at Ukrainian media sort of in the way that I think a lot of national media in the United States, my home country, looks at local media, right? Which is, you know, we often look at local media in the United States, or me as a foreign correspondent, I look at Ukrainian media to generate ideas. I notice trends in local media. For example, I might see a report about, let's say, a court case regarding collaborators in Sumy. And I might think that's interesting and then look for similar court cases and maybe I spot some kind of trend and then it becomes a story that we publish at the Financial Times. And it becomes a bigger, you know, a bigger, broader story. It's an international story now, right? It's Ukraine's efforts to track down collaborators and people who are, you know, working against the state and you know the many cases that they have open against these people. So it could be something like that, for example. So in that sense, you know, Ukrainian media is valuable to me because oftentimes I generate my story ideas by reading local media. You know, I think. The sheer amount of media that comes out is impressive in wartime. You know, I think despite the sort of state censors that come with martial law, I've been pleasantly surprised to see a lot of solid and critical reporting done by independent media. You know, Radio Svoboda, Ukrainska Pravda, NV, they all do great stuff. Nasha Groshi as well, right? They have done some of the reporting that has made big headlines, not just in Ukraine, but internationally, right? Nasha Groshi and I think Ukrainska Pravda, and you know, they have done stories on corruption, even in wartime, that I was very impressed by, and that led to myself and my colleagues also covering those stories. You know, Maybe I will stop there, but I think just one last thing actually that I find helpful is that the journalist community in Ukraine is a very tight-knit group, I think, and that stems from even before wartime here, having you know, governments oppress them and always being under pressure, and I think that made the Ukrainian media world a very tight-knit community. Over the last many years, especially the last 2 years, I think, you know, that community has also included and brought in foreign correspondents like myself. I spend a lot of time socializing with Ukrainian media, and that has helped me better understand Ukraine and the Ukrainian media world. I think it's also helped them, Ukrainian journalists, understand where we as foreign correspondents come from, what our editors are interested in, what interests us as correspondents. And so there is, I think more than at any other time in my 14 years here, this real collegial sense between the two. At the same time, I do sense some competition and frustration. And I will admit that it does seem at times unfair that Ukraine's leadership, including President Zelensky, you know, does not often give, or it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, please, Yulia in particular, if you think that I'm wrong in that, I do find that, you know, anecdotally, it seems like Zelensky and a lot of Ukrainian leadership give more interviews to us in foreign media. And that could be because they need Western support, right? And American support in particular, military assistance is critical. But I think it would answer a lot of questions that Ukrainians have if the Ukrainian leadership and the president in particular would sit down for more interviews in Ukrainian media. And that in turn would also help us out to get a better sense of the sort of local mood in Ukraine as well. I'll stop there so you can ask some more questions.
Yeah,
I can only chime in about that.
Yeah,
about
please.
May I chime in? Just, I just remembered the moment in our newsroom or our conference call with my colleagues in London when I said that Zelensky gave an interview to some Ukrainian channel, and I mentioned that this was actually his first interview to Ukrainian media. And my producer, coordinating producer, said, "But what? It's been like a year and a half since the start of the full-scale invasion. And is this really his first interview to Ukrainian media? I mean, he was all over the international media." I totally agree on that point.
I want to follow up on that also because several years ago, anecdotally, I want to share an anecdote from several years ago. Never happened, but I was preparing to do a possible let's say it's more of an exercise, but I was thinking, what if a foreign journalist were to interview Bashar al-Assad in Syria? Different situation, but I noticed that a lot of journalists would try to sort of catch him. There was a famous moment where the journalist pulled out a photo and of the child in the ambulance, face covered in dust. And the journalist asked him, like, do you cry when you see this photo? And I just thought it was such a fail of a moment because it was sort of like the foreign media trying to win some points or something. Anyway, what I thought would be the right approach is actually to talk about, in the case of Syria, you know, like Syrian media can't effectively ask Bashar al-Assad questions that are actually on the minds of Syrians. But what I thought should be the role of foreign journalists is to speak about real issues that are affecting people in that country, while also fulfilling their job about what is important to an international audience. So I think that what that makes me think of is the role of foreign media and what is important to an international audience and what is of interest, but at the same time balancing that what is actually relevant on the ground. And those can be two different things, but I think that there is a space where they can be combined. And I think that foreign media and local media have a lot to learn from each other and should be working together. I have sort of taken the approach, which is very different from Chris's. In past places where I've covered the Middle East, I sort of stuck with the journalist crowd, but in Ukraine, I've taken the approach to just only stick with Ukrainians and learn from them and avoid the journalist. But I think that can create, I think the space for the best work to be done is when journalists can carry the issues that are on the minds of Ukrainians and then turn that into something that is relevant to the international media because it's actually the feeling on the ground. And I think that's the best way to intervene. And so that could be, that can be, there are times when a story is not relevant to an international audience. And I think sometimes with the issue of corruption, Ukrainian journalists are in a tough place because they feel like if we report on corruption too much, then that could serve Russian narratives and that would feed people who think that, this is a corrupt country and that justifies invasion somehow. But I think that we shouldn't shy away from that because Ukrainians do care about corruption and it does help you. I think when I speak to people, they tell me, it doesn't hurt Ukraine to report on corruption. That helps Ukraine to spotlight corruption in order to fix it and to eradicate it. And that's something that people do care about. They don't want their country to be corrupt. They do want a stronger enforcement of laws that are not followed through on. And a lot of local issues that they might not be relevant to, I don't know, the simplest example is like, there's a lot of people who build stuff on top of buildings and it's not correct according to the zoning laws because, it's historical architecture here in Kyiv that, it's not legal for people to build a new penthouse on top of a historical building, but that's not really enforced. Is that relevant to an international audience? Probably not, because it's small stuff, or like cars that park where they shouldn't, and it's not enforced or something. Is that relevant to an international audience? No, but when there is a case that that people here want to highlight, and that's, I think they see the purpose of media attention is to get politicians to move when they're not doing something about an issue. So I think on certain cases, there are instances where foreign media and local media can work together. As Chris said, I mean, what I'll call local Ukrainian media highlight issues, and then, foreign media notice the trends and then can work to contextualize that for an international audience so that it fits the interest and also can speak to what people are feeling on the ground.
Okay, Sean, I think it's a great transition to our final block before the questions from the audience. And I would like to start it with my personal observation, if I may. Of course, I believe that journalism and media in Ukraine is not just about reporting, of course, and it also includes some strategies, constant balancing, like between telling the truth about everything that happened immediately, or, for example, waiting until the official government sources can publish something. And I'm referencing to the places of Russian attacks in particular, and probably the same applies to actually what Sean just said about kind of hot news about some corruption scandals, but potentially or some changes kind of within the government, and I think everyone in Ukraine really doubts kind of whether it's okay to post something. Like, are you helping Ukraine right now, or are you helping Russia in covering that, and stuff like that? So I have two questions for everyone, and also you're really welcome to reflect on each other's statements. And I would like to start with Yulia. How would you assess kind of what Ukraine is doing in terms of its international communications, both from the private sector, from the civil society part, from NGOs, and from the state? And the second, which you actually almost started to answer, is actually what would you do differently if you were advising President Zelensky, for example, or the government on communication, and in particular regarding international communication?
Well, you know, first of all, let's accept that we're saying this as journalists, not professional advisors on communication, right? We are sort of a media that is in between the audience, some politicians in the US, in Ukraine, NGOs, ordinary people. First of all, it's obvious that we are becoming less let's say Ukraine or Ukrainian authorities, diplomats are becoming less creative in communicating the need to help Ukraine, to provide more weapons, to stop believing in whatever crap Russia is saying. I understand that's difficult, but maybe at some point we have to start painting the most pessimistic scenario that might happen to Europe and the US. I'm very happy that Emmanuel Macron started saying things that he started saying. I understand because of his political goals probably, but that's actually is very helpful now, especially when the aid to Ukraine is stuck in the US Congress. So probably we should start at some point describing the most pessimistic scenario so that Europe and the West started waking up even more, because they've already awakened, but to make them even more sober. And to do that not from the point of view of, not from a position of a victim, but from a position of a fair player, equal player, and an equal participant of this political, geopolitical process, right? The most important thing I would do differently if I were the president, God forbid. They've done poor, miserable job communicating with the Republicans. It's all about the Republicans now, right? It's mostly about the American aid, right? And now it's mostly about the Republicans, because the aid is stuck because of them. The president's office has done a miserable job communicating them since day one, since 2019, since the Zelensky Trump story, if you remember, right? So what they should do, for example, Zelensky was in DC in December, right, last year. So he said something like he was rumbling and saying, "Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Joe Biden. Thank you, Biden again. Thank you, Joe Biden." What he should have done probably is, "Thank you, Mr. President." And I also want to take a minute and say thank you to all the American people, because the patriot systems that you provide us, they help to save life of this, say, little girl Oksana, or 5-year-old boy Andriy, wherever in Kharkiv or in Kyiv. They could have died, but the patriots that you provided us saved those lives. They make it real. The Republican audience is a kind of, I mean, I'm generalizing, but the Republicans are people who are probably keeping a gun in their closet, and they like to watch action movies, and they like to feel themselves as heroes. So if you make a Republican who is watching your press conference on the news feel like a hero, like he saved someone's lives, that would probably be a better communication. It's just a random idea.
Okay, I cannot miss an opportunity to comment as well before I turn to Chris. As the head of the Institute of American Studies and Geo in Ukraine, I would really like to say a lot, but I'm just a moderator today. But basically, just to your point that I believe President Zelensky actually many times he thanked the American people, and in particular actually those in Congress from both sides of the aisle, and probably not so much as he should be, I agree, but actually many times he really did that. Or actually, maybe that approach that kind of you proposed about making connections to the personal stories. I also heard kind of that idea from many international journalists, and probably that maybe what we'll be, I would say, watching soon, because the American support to Ukraine is still needed, and probably that approach will be kind of relevant. Okay, Chris, what's your take on international communications from Ukraine? And if you were about to advise the president and the government on international communications, actually, what would be your advice in particular?
Gosh, well, I would like to remain a journalist and not advise any governments on their communications. But if I were to do so, I suppose, I guess first I'll give Ukraine and Zelensky some credit here, because I actually think that Ukraine very generally has done a great job over the last couple of years, considering the challenges and the difficulty and the situation that they found them in. And I think Zelensky's, probably most important decision simply to stay put, not to flee Kyiv, and to remain here, and to use his skills as an orator and somebody who has experience behind the camera, to utilize social media in the way that he did in those early weeks was, I think, no less than brilliant, and also equally, very brave. I think he's done, generally a very good job. I think there are several things I might have done differently at different stages of the war in terms of, how he communicated, or the tone of that communication with some Western partners that I think at various moments helped, but at others came off as more grating. I think if I had to advise the president right now, I would say Ukraine's at a particularly challenging moment. I think that what is I think important right now is transparency and honesty. I would probably advise the president, who is not great with dealing with public criticism of himself and his administration, that you know, a bit of radical honesty is probably in order. He needs to be frank with the Ukrainian people, tell them about the things that are going well, but also the things that are not going very well, and that could very likely get worse in the current situation. And that is not only Ukraine's doing, but it's also, you know, my country's failure to provide continual military assistance. But he's probably going to have to make some very, very difficult decisions this year. Those decisions are going to be need to be made for the sake of Ukraine's Ukraine's survival, right? This is an existential war. So he should be out there, you know, telling Ukrainians that he's taking full responsibility. And that while these decisions are going to be tough and painful, they need to happen. I would tell him, you know, to take responsibility for mobilization. Right now, there's a bill in parliament that you all know is very controversial. It's a complete mess with thousands of amendments, and nobody seems to want to take responsibility for it because it is controversial and deeply unpopular. But I think Zelensky, being the president, needs to step up. And even if that costs him some popularity and percentage points in polling, he needs to step up and take responsibility for that. Mobilization, manpower is probably the number one challenge that Ukraine faces this year, not too far ahead of ammunition and weapons. But you know, I think those things he should be doing sooner rather than later. I would maybe categorize it broadly as a dose of realism, right? I think the propaganda that has been fed to the public for 2 years is no longer really doing the service that it did early on to unite the country. And I think Ukrainians have I trust Ukrainians to have a pretty good sense of how things are right now. You know, there's hardly anybody in this country that hasn't been directly impacted by this war. I think the latest poll, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, the latest polling here showed that more than 70% of Ukrainians have been directly impacted by, know someone who has, I think, been killed or wounded in the war, right? I mean, that is a huge number of people. And I would argue that it's probably higher. And if they don't have a direct connection to someone who has unfortunately been killed by Russia's aggression, then they certainly are aware of friends and further acquaintances who have. And so I think just generally, you know, I think it's time for some real talk on the part of the administration. I think that's also going to help Ukrainian media and feeling less pressure about writing stories that are uncomfortable for the administration. They're going to feel more confident and comfortable and knowing that they're not going to be attacked for writing a story that could be viewed as critical in a negative sense. Because I don't think criticism has to be negative. Criticism can be constructive. And when it is, it is for the better, right? It can help to improve situations.
Absolutely. And I think these points are always important to keep in mind when we are talking about domestic kind of situation in Ukraine and actually what the president and his team are through every day. Sean, I would like to hear your take as well before we move to our some questions from our audience.
I mean, great points, Chris and Julia. I agree with what's been said. And I mean, if I were to advise the president and the government here, I would advise them to help us do our job. I think journalists. I'm a believer. I truly believe that the best way to get people to your side of understanding is using the truth, is using facts and working like a journalist. That I think is the best way to respect people enough to make their own decisions about what is the state's policy, what are public policies that are going to affect them. So I think, as Chris said, Zelensky did a great job of doing what needed to be done in the first, the first phase after full-scale invasion. And what's going to be needed for the country is changing. And there are hard decisions that need to be made now. I mean, a lot of people are worried about potential mobilization and how that's going to affect their life. I think so a dose of honesty is very needed. I think also something that Zelensky did a good job of is that he was really not afraid to be actively engaged in what were the points of conversation of the day. I remember, the drone attacks on Kyiv were something really serious at the moment. And at the time, Iran was saying, like, you don't supply drones to Russia. And then I think, like, the next day, he just, like, went on camera, like, next to the Iranian drone that was next to him on the floor. And he just, like, quickly, just like that, like, he responded to that immediately head on. So I think, I think that he shouldn't be afraid to listen to what people are saying and not shy away from directly responding to that. As Yulia said, Americans love their guns. That's certainly a fact. And, I think that there should be some direct dialogue with that issue that, like, I think... if I were him and I was speaking, or if I was speaking to a gun-loving Republican, I would say, what is the point of having guns if when somebody needs it that you don't use them? It's my opinion. One of the things I'd like to say to Republicans if I had the chance. I think dealing directly with the questions that people have on their mind and not shying away from them. And then secondly, helping us do our job. I think this is maybe something logistical for us journalists who work here in Ukraine, but I think that we'd like to see more accessibility from officials, especially when it comes to access to military zones. Of course, it's understandable why they are not so inclined to let journalists except in most areas, journalists can go freely, but when it comes to frontline areas, it's quite difficult to arrange the access to get there for obvious reasons that the military needs to know who's coming to their areas and to keep, they have sort of a responsibility to make sure that nothing, do their best to try to protect them, although there's been a lot of journalists killed, too many, and that's a difficult subject that I don't need to go into, but I think the journalists here would like to see more accessibility from officials and to areas so that we can continue doing our job.
Okay, and basically, that's it from my side. Now we are turning to your questions. And actually, while our speakers will be answering some questions from our audience that have been submitted in advance, I would really like to appeal to those listening us online. And you can also prepare your questions and you will have a chance to ask them. Okay, basically we have two questions, and the second, basically the first one is a bit short, and I would like to start with Chris about it, probably then Sean, and then Yulia. Can you share some of the most memorable moments that stood out to you while reporting from Ukraine that impacted your understanding of the war in ways you might have not anticipated? So the question is kind of, did these kind of memories challenge your assumptions about the war? And actually, did it influence the way of reporting that you are doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I will actually go back further than or beyond or back in time before 2022 and say that, you know, I think the first major event that I covered here as a correspondent that really had an impact on me was Maidan, the year of Maidan revolution, or what turned it into the revolution of dignity. That was deeply inspiring. You know, seeing, you know, people spill into the streets, you know, to defend their freedoms and dignity. That was incredibly inspiring. That same spirit that carried over into, you know, volunteering as medics and soldiers to stop Russia's aggression in the Donbass in 2014 was equally as inspiring. And I think, you know, it was actually in 2014 that I got, you know, my first look at that, and also my first glimpse into what Russia and its soldiers were capable of. So what had a really impact on me, for instance, was also one of the bigger stories that I reported on and wrote, was about, many of you will recognize the name Igor Strokov or Igor Girkin, the Russian former FSB officer who's now in jail in Russia for criticizing Putin, but who, you know, helped with Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 before moving over to Slavyansk and fighting there and leading, you know, local militant fighters with Russian operatives and soldiers. And the story that I was wanting to bring up was discovering a stack of documents in his office after he fled his office in Slavyansk that proved he and a group of other soldiers were carrying out executions by firing squad of people there, and that to me illustrated the brutality that Russia was capable of and prepared to carry out in order, to laud over Ukraine, to control Ukraine. And so, you know, reporting on that, seeing other instances, come 2022, you know, a lot of this I was prepared for, but still shocked to see, you know, atrocities in Bucha, certainly was a moment for everyone, I think. That really, well, you know, besides being disturbing, I think really cemented in everyone's mind that, you know, what Russia is capable of are you know, monstrous acts, and that this really was a war of, you know, an existential war, a war of survival for Ukraine. You know, there have been plenty of inspiring moments too. You know, that sort of volunteer spirit is always something that, I've found deeply inspiring, and seeing people rush to defend their country at the very beginning of the full-scale invasion certainly was that. It was a terrifying moment, fraught with uncertainty. Nobody knew what was happening and what would happen and what they would wake up to the next day. And I think Kiev came very close to falling, closer than a lot of people, I think, truly know. And it was only because of that, that response by ordinary people who, you know, were willing to do extraordinary things that allowed Kiev to stand and for us to be sitting here talking as we are, you know, today.
Yeah.
I think that's what makes me, if I can just make a quick and jump in, but I think that what, like Chris said, what makes Ukraine seem really special to me is the way ordinary people come together and help each other through this war. It's kind of like that moment when you realize that something is really happening around you and you start to actually talk to your neighbors. I remember especially when there were huge power blackouts last year, the way that people would check in on their neighbors and help each other and just to really actually look at their neighbors, because it's so common living in a city that you will just like sort of go about your life and ignore your neighbors, but people really started to become kind of conscious and look around and check in on people and help them and offer that when somebody doesn't have water on this street, people would say like, where is there you know, there's groups where people are constantly in contact, finding out where is their electricity, where can you take a shower. And then also, so that, you know, just really made an impression on me. And the other thing is, I think just today's Thursday, I think Tuesday, I was meeting a friend and passed by a bar, and somebody came outside and said that we're calling attention to everyone. If you'd like to come inside, we're going to say goodbye to a Ukrainian hero. And I said, let's go inside and see what it is. And at first we thought that it was probably someone who was like going off to join the military and was having a send-off with his friends. And they showed a video on a projection screen, and it showed like these kind of funny home videos of this guy when he was a teenager and as an adult with friends and having fun. And then I kind of realized that it wasn't saying goodbye for even going to war, that it was a memorial and that he had died. And there was like 100 people just on a bar on a Tuesday night memorializing this soldier that, you know, that probably a bar he went to with his friends. And it's a real person that, you know, this is what's happening on a random Tuesday in a random bar in Kyiv, is that people are saying goodbye to friends that they used to drink with. And that just, you know, tells me that it's really real what people are going through. And it's really special that the way that they come together.
Okay. Yulia, please.
I think I would recall three special moments, and also I would go back to 2014 to it was mid-January when the first death on Maidan happened. First people were killed. There was a moment I kind of understood that this is actually something bigger than just a peaceful protest for to support European integration. It was a typical scenario of how you do a coup, and how you, in terms externally, how you distract people from something bigger, which was actually an annexation of Crimea. That was a turning point. I remember that clearly because I was talking to my friend who is actually Crimean Tatar, and she has these connections among the Crimean Tatars, Crimean Tatar politicians, and she said, I think they will grab Crimea. I remember that phrase. I think they will grab Crimea. The second moment was the day before the full-scale invasion, when we reported that there was a meeting of the president with some of the MPs and military intelligence and law enforcement. And they reported to him that in the following two days, the situation on the front line would deteriorate. And we kind of understood that it's going to happen like tomorrow, because on February 11th, we already knew that this is, as our sources in Pentagon, they told us, this is no bullshit. Go to Lviv. We had a contingency plan in Lviv where we stay if something really happens. So on February 11th, we moved to Lviv. I stayed in Kyiv, and we reported that this thing about the situation, what's going to happen. And the third moment was the next day, on the day of the invasion. I remember that we reported that at 4:30 or something, when the first explosions occurred in Kyiv, and then when everyone went to sleep after an early work, I saw Zelensky recording a selfie video and saying that I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. There was a moment for me, I understood that it's gonna be okay. On the other hand, I later saw my colleague, foreign correspondent, he's British. I saw him, you know, that he has this perception that Ukraine is going to lose because, you know, he spent too much time reporting from Moscow, and he stays, you know, he's emotionally impressed that Russia is a big, huge bear, scary, powerful. So Ukraine is going to lose. And he was, you know, looking for the facts or paying more attention to the facts that actually fit into this, his way of thinking, this framework. And for example, he was like paying attention to how many Ukrainian soldiers were killed in some battle, although it was like a few hours into this invasion. And I was like, we've just agreed that we do not report on casualties because it's going to be underestimated from the Ukrainian side, overestimated from the Russian side, so it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, he was sort of looking for these facts that fit into his idea that Ukraine is going to lose. And I was like, I think the Ukrainian army will prove you wrong, but we'll see, we'll see. And of course, as Chris said, and as Sean said, many things were inspiring, like people who actually start checking in on each other and helping each other and collaborate. Many awful things really made me think, like, is this even real? Because of all these atrocities, all these things that happened in Mariupol, we know about them thanks to brilliant reporting of AP journalists. Those were major sins as well. But I also think that the biggest things are still ahead, and we will see them hopefully, and we will report on them.
Absolutely. I have only the last question from the audience that has been submitted in advance, and I will ask all of you to be brief, although the question is a bit long, but I'm trying to summarize it. Is the vision of Ukraine and Ukrainian issues still formed in the world from Russian disinformation narratives? And in addition, the question is, does the world audience understand that this 10-year war of Russia and Ukraine is built precisely on the destruction of Ukrainian identity and on a genocidal approach? And I think the question is about kind of comparison, like between actually 2014 and probably nowadays.
Could I start? Because I'm sorry, yeah. But I'll have to run.
Yeah, Chris, absolutely.
You know, I'll keep my answer short. I think if you look at, if you were to ask people now what they know about Ukraine, they would be able to tell you a lot more about the place, the people, its leadership, events here than they would have if you asked them in 2014. Without a doubt, more people know about Ukraine today, and what they know is much better than what they were hearing about before, or what, you know, what they may have thought of. It's no longer thought of as some backwater Eastern European country. I think, generally most people don't refer to it as, you know, the post-Soviet state, Ukraine, right? People do view it as an independent state. They do understand Ukraine's aspirations to become a European nation. I think there are more people now than ever before who view it as a partner nation, and not some foreign place. I think the internet and social media has helped a lot with that, right? It doesn't feel like it's so far away. These videos that Zelensky puts out every evening, the videos of Russian attacks, the photographs and videos that we see posted online from journalists, it all helps to bring the war much closer to people and into their homes. I think a lot of people feel almost like they're here sometimes for those who follow really intensely, and that's overall a positive. And I'll just end by saying, you know, Russia's disinformation is pervasive, it's still there, but a lot of people have learned to tune it out and to recognize it, and I don't think it has the same impact that it did in 2014, and certainly not in prior to that too. I think there's been a lot of learning and understanding that's happened in the last 10 years, And that's why a lot of it has not really stuck or really impacted the situation, I would argue, in the last year or so. With that, can I just please say thank you very much? And I apologize, I have to take off. But
absolutely,
you
know, Chris.
Thank you. This was fantastic, everybody, for the
thank you
for the great conversation.
Thank you. We do appreciate your time. Thank you. So, Yulia, and then Sean for the final remarks. And if there are no questions from the audience, that will be all for today.
Yeah, just to save our time, I will support totally what Chris said. Absolutely, people abroad now know much more about Ukraine than they used to 10 years ago or even 2 years ago. Of course, there are people, even among, I would say, congressional staffers who still believe that crap that Russia is spending. Just because Russia is spending tons of money on spreading disinformation, and there is no use beating disinformation, it just doesn't work. What we should do is reflexive control, but that's another question that we have already discussed about a way of communication of Ukrainian government, for example. As for this question about genocide, it's a little bit more complicated, and I think it's just about legal framework. It's about war crimes. It's just a category of war crimes. It's a category of international law, and I don't think like the average people will follow. Like, they won't wake up in the middle of the night and thinking, "Oh, is it a genocidal war? I don't remember." But did any court recognize this war as a war of genocide? I mean, this is legal framework. But definitely there is still way to go for Ukraine in not countering disinformation, again, as I said, but spreading more pro-Ukraine narratives from the position of an equal partner, a partner nation.
Absolutely. Sean, please.
I think the best antidote to propaganda, especially genocidal propaganda in support of a genocidal war, is to show the truth of what Ukrainians actually are. I mean, I think there's so much to be done and there's so much to be covered here in Ukraine just about culture. I mean, does anybody know that Ukrainian beer is great? It's like as good as Belgian beer. It's amazing. Like, does anybody know that like Ukrainian fashion is so deep? Ukrainian food. I mean, everyone should read Yevgeny Klopotenko and how he talks about food and Ukrainian and how closely connected the parsnip is to Ukrainian identity. And I mean, the way that every sector of the society, artists and musicians, is mobilized to help their community, their country win this war and recover from what's been destroyed. I mean, that alone, I think, like once you see that, if you came to Ukraine and saw all of that going on, there's no way that you can possibly believe that, that this is like some kind of Nazi regime that is like oppressing people, that is marginalizing Russian speakers. Like, there's no way that if you saw the reality, you could buy into Russian propaganda. And so our job is to simply, I think we'll get a lot from just showing the truth of how much Ukrainian society exists and is thriving. That's the vaccine to any kind of a propaganda.
Absolutely. And basically, this is the final call to those listening to us online. It's more than 1 hour and 20 minutes. And if you have some questions, this is exactly the time. If not, Well, of course, actually, we and I in particular have a lot of questions, but I'm afraid we will have to leave it there. So, thank you everyone for participating today. Thank you, our incredible speakers. You made this event really, really fascinating, and we do appreciate your time and your contribution. Of course, we'll be also hosting events soon. So stay in touch and read Rubrica in English and support Ukraine. We are actually, all of us are working toward a very clear goal to make Ukraine win in this hard but important war. Thank you very much. Slava Ukraini!